From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kapler.
Recent reports have uncovered the alarming frequency that foster care providers are turning to a risky but convenient remedy to control the behavior of thousands of troubled kids: numbing them with psychiatric drugs. A new study by the California State Auditor, Elaine Howe, confirms the overuse of psychotropic drugs in the state's foster care system. What should be done? We'll ask our guest, Elaine Howe, the California State Auditor.
We'll also talk about a Valley program in Madera County singled out for doing things the right way when we talk to Danny Morris, the Deputy Director of the Department of Social Services for the County of Madera.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. The State Auditor recently released a report on the foster care program and the shocking use of psychotropic medicines on foster youth. Elaine Howe, the State Auditor, is with us here to talk about those findings. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Pleased to be here.
So people probably think they know all about the foster care system, but can you give us kind of an overview of California's foster care system?
Sure. The foster care system in California is essentially a social welfare system that's administered not only by the state of California, but federal government supports it and certainly the local level counties. And the foster care system, kids enter that system through two different avenues. One may be through county welfare, where a child is taken out of the home because the parents just don't have the ability to properly care for that child. Some kids come through the juvenile system where they become a ward of the court because they're getting into trouble and they're beyond the ability of the parent to take care of that child and discipline that child. So that child may come into the system and be placed in foster care because he or she's been getting in a lot of trouble.
Okay, so difficult situations are being addressed by the state. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a number of governmental agencies that have their hands in this. You have the federal government, the state government, the county, local level. Mm-hmm. Who's responsible for what? Who pays for what?
Right. There are. The federal government pays a fairly substantial share. It's between 50% and 75%, depending on the type of care that's provided to the child, whether it's health care services or administrative type services. There's a percentage of the cost that the federal government pays for. And then the state and local governments also chip in a certain amount of money. And recently, realignment a few years ago pushed a lot of state taxes, vehicle fees, et cetera, down to the locals, and they use some of that money to support foster care kits.
Okay, and realignment was Governor Brown's attempt to kind of push some of this stuff down to the local level, the thought being that locals could handle the situation better maybe than at the state level.
Exactly.
It seems like there's a lot of troubled kids in this system, I'm guessing. What is, are there more troubled kids in foster care, I assume there are, than the general population?
Well, there are a lot of kids in foster care in California. There's upwards of 80,000, I think it's 79 some odd thousand children in the foster care system. And clearly, many of these kids are troubled for a variety of reasons. They are coming out of a traumatic situation. They've been taken out of their home, or they've gotten into trouble.
It could be physical abuse, sexual abuse.
Absolutely. Okay. It could be any type of abuse, neglect, et cetera. So these kids, have already gone through a traumatic situation and now are in the foster care system and as we're going to talk about today, being administered some very significant drugs.
Yeah, so some of them are prescribed medications. How many are being prescribed medications?
In California, it's about 12%. So over about 9,700 children that we found in the database that actually were receiving prescriptions for psychotropic medications, which are antipsychotics, antidepressants, in some cases stimulants. Very powerful.
It sounds like pretty powerful stuff.
Right. Very powerful medications.
And how does that compare to the general population? It's quite a bit lower in the general population?
Typically, it's much lower in the general population. We looked at some studies and California, as I said, about 12% of the foster kids are on these types of medications. In the general population, it ranges between 5 and 10%, depending on which study you look at.
So you could be as many as twice as many of these kids are on medications than the typical normal population.
Yes, that's correct.
And people already talk about, these days about people overprescribe medications for kids as opposed to what they were doing 20, 30, 40 years ago. So I assume there are some kind of standards for the safe and appropriate use of these psychotropic medicines on foster children.
If so, who sets that standard? Is that a federal standard, a state standard, a local? Is it, you know, a psychological association? Mm-hmm. Who sets the standards?
Well, there actually are state guidelines. It's not necessarily set in state law, but there are guidelines that the state of California has put together, the Department of Social Services, Health Services. And when they put those guidelines together, they looked at the Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and some other experts who, out there who have best practices, and they put together some best practices and their guidance for counties to follow.
So it's not a requirement?
Not necessarily a requirement.
I'm wondering if there's legal liability. You know, it's a guidance, but if you don't follow it, I suppose you expose yourself to more legal liability. That's a separate question. But so there are guidelines that the state's adopted. Mm-hmm. And can you give me some examples? I think you were talking on your report about, for example, follow-up 1 month after a child receives medication to see how the medication's working. Those are the kind of guidelines we're talking about?
Right. That's one type of guideline where a child is prescribed a certain medication, and ideally it should be within 2 weeks, but at a maximum 30 days. And what we found is some kids weren't being seen for months. But that's one example of guidance.
Okay. Well, I was wondering, there's some other things you also talked about, and also the total number of meds given to children. Obviously, the younger the child, I would assume, the lower the dosage probably should be, correct?
Right. The guidance that was put out does split it up by age group. So, for example, a child between zero, an infant, and 5 years old should be only receiving one medication, and then it goes up as the child
Is
older.
It's hard to believe that someone would actually give them more than one medication when they're only, you know, 0 to 5 years old. But well, thank you for explaining the psychotropic meds used in the foster care system up to this point. Up next, what is the state auditor's startling findings on this? Up next on the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with State Auditor Elaine Howell about a recent report her office issued on the over-medication of children in the state's foster care system. So let's get right to the bottom line. Is there a problem with the way psychotropic medicines are being prescribed and monitored in foster care?
Absolutely. We looked at statewide data, but we also went and visited four counties. And what we found consistently is that children are receiving more medications than they should for their age. The dosages are in excess of what the maximum dosage should be. And in some cases, they're receiving multiple medications within the same drug class, which, again, the state guidance says you should not do. So across the board, we found problems at all four counties.
And I would assume then there are short-term effects and there are long-term effects. Consequences of this. So the short-term effects would be, you know, it does calm volatile moods, right? If they're excitable, this helps calm them down, but I assume there are some side effects.
These are very, very strong medications, like you were referring to, antipsychotics, stimulants, antidepressants. And the side effects are weight gain, weight loss, fatigue, sleep disturbance, pain. So very significant.
Zombies, too. You're just, you're
very significant side effects.
And I assume also then there are long-term side effects as well.
There certainly could be with respect to these types of medications, particularly if a child is not being monitored or being seen by a prescribing physician.
Yeah, you don't know what effect that drug is really having on it. You just prescribe it and kind of walk away. So you actually looked at 80 cases. You examined 80 cases. Mm-hmm. How often did you find that the amounts of the drugs and the dosages of the drugs given to foster children were beyond state guidelines, exceeded state guidelines?
So we did visit four counties. Los Angeles, Madera, Riverside, and Sonoma.
Very different counties, by the way.
Yeah, we wanted to get rural, you know, obviously
urban,
L.A.,
yeah.
a huge county, and get a cross-section of the state of California. And as far as excess dosages, 23%. So about 12 kids that we looked at out of the 80 cases were receiving excess dosages.
About a quarter of the kids.
Right, pretty close to 25% of those.
It seems
those
like for some people it might be a simple way to handle a problem child to just give more medicine and kind of make them a zombie, essentially. And that's really, that's dangerous on many levels.
It's certainly a concern that not only you know, the state of California should have, but the social workers, the probation officers, et cetera, the caregivers for this particular child should be well aware and be monitoring, doing a better job
of
monitoring.
And a similar number you had 14% of the cases you studied, the kids were given multiple psychotropic medicines in the same drug class.
That's correct.
Like double dosing.
Right. So all three of those conditions that I identified earlier, we saw problems at all of the counties. And the percentages, like you said, 14% for the multiple classes. As far as the age, it was about 11%. And we just talked about 25% getting, you know, excessive dosages of medications.
So it seems like a problem of oversight here. Is it the county's responsibility?
I think the responsibility is across the board. Certainly at the county level, there should be more oversight and more direct monitoring of this, of the children and the medications they're being prescribed. But you have the medical board that should be paying attention to the physicians who are prescribing the medications, and certainly the state agencies, social services, and healthcare services have a role as well.
Well, let me ask you, though, about the county. Let's kind of focus on that for a second. There are supposed to be sometimes court authorization for this, right, for medicines. There's also could be parental consent. Mm-hmm. In your report, though, you found that a substantial percentage are not getting court authorization before they give these medicines or parental consent.
Absolutely. That was a major concern for us, that there is a process. It needs to go through the court. It needs to be authorized by the court that this child needs this medication and what the prescription should be. Also, what you're looking for in court records is what kind of mental health services, called psychosocial services, behavioral services, are these children receiving in conjunction with the medication. That's critically important, and we didn't see that happening.
It's interesting, the numbers in your report, about a third, 30, I don't want to get too specific on numbers, it's about a third of the situations, they don't get court authorization or parental consent.
Right.
A third, one out of every three, that's quite a bit. So state has some responsibility here. Mm-hmm. They dropped the ball?
I think the state of California needs to do a better job. Certainly the Department of Social Services and Healthcare Services do conduct some oversight, but what we found is, with respect to this particular issue, the prescription of psychotropic medications to children, they were not managing that, not overseeing that. So when they were going out and doing reviews, this was not part of their plan to assess how well this particular part of managing foster children and providing services to these
kids. Specifically says that these state agencies cannot completely identify which foster children are even getting these medicines.
That's true, and that's part of, I think we're going to talk about it, this fragmented system, because social services has certain information about foster kids, healthcare services has certain information about foster kids, and they're not talking to each other. So there's no comprehensive place to see all the medications a child's receiving, what types of services, et cetera. It's very fragmented.
I want to ask you also about, you mentioned these psychosocial services, follow-up visits. That's also a problem, too. They don't know, either it's not happening or they're not monitoring what is happening in that regard, correct?
That's correct. And looking at, again, when we looked at the 80 case files, we were actually looking at paper files, looking to see what kind of medications are these children on. Comparing it to the database, there might be information in their personal file called their health and education passport for a child. Looking in the database, well, that medication's not recorded in the database, or a mental health services, or a follow-up visit is supposed to be happening. It's not being tracked in that electronic database.
Okay, we're going to talk up next about some of the systemic reasons for this epidemic of over-medication of foster children. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking to the state auditor, Elaine Howe, about her office's recent report on how psychotropic medicines are being under-monitored and over-prescribed in the foster care system. We were talking earlier about the fragmented nature of the child welfare system, and that may be the culprit. Too many cooks in the kitchen?
I don't know if it's too many cooks in the kitchen, but the cooks aren't talking to each other and communicating with one another about what information they have versus what, as I said, social services versus healthcare services. But also at the local level, the caregivers working with the prescribing physician to make sure that they have the information and that it gets put in that child's health and education passport. So that information, that profile of that child is accurate and complete with respect to medications and psychosocial services.
And what you're talking about, it's not just a fragmented system in terms of who's getting what, but then data collection as to be able to go back and see, okay, are there problems here? You don't even have that here.
Right. You don't even have all of the information about the child as to whether or not the medications that child has been prescribed is reflected in his or her health and education passport and is reflected in the data. So even if the state agencies were communicating with one another, if they have incomplete data, they're not making good decisions about the care for that child.
The garbage in, garbage out kind of analogy. You know, you mentioned several times now this passport, health and education passport. So can you explain kind of what that is? It seems like this would be the way to solve the problem. Look at the passport. I assume it collects the information and then act appropriately. So what are these health and education passports and what's the problem here?
So a health and education passport is essentially a profile for a child. It's the paperwork related to that child. So if a caregiver for a child, a foster parent, is taking that child to a physician and that child is being prescribed some type of antipsychotic, that needs to be reflected in the paperwork. So then when the parent or the social worker goes back to the county welfare system, make sure that information gets input into the database. Social services is aware of it. And then healthcare services, if it's a Medi-Cal recipient, the information is reflected in there. So this passport really is a profile for a child. Why it's critically important is Many times these children unfortunately go from one placement to another, and that is their record that follows them. And if that record is incomplete, a new caregiver, a new social worker will not have all of the appropriate information to make good decisions about
that
child.
That's a great point, because they probably do move from home to home or situation to situation.
Right.
You know, you were mentioning also, you did some, collected some data on these 80 passports, and you found that in all 80 passports, they had incorrect start dates on the psychotropic meds. They didn't even know when it started.
That's correct.
You also found that in all 80, it was missing information about the corresponding psychosocial services that were being offered after the medication.
Right.
And in 16%, you found that they couldn't identify the actual meds that the children were taking.
That's correct. That's why we had significant concerns, because this is such an important element to this child's care in the foster care system. If they don't know, the caregiver doesn't know what prescription medications this child is on, and if the child's exhibiting some type of behavior, is in pain or is weight loss, weight gain, and you don't know that child's on a certain type of medication that's causing that, you don't know how to address the issue.
You know, even from a family situation, my mom had some blood pressure issues, and she was overprescribed, and she was getting dizzy spells. Mm-hmm. We went back and we took a close look at it. We reduced the dosage. It went away.
Right.
So inappropriate dosage really can have an effect on someone.
Certainly, and some of these children are very young, and so they don't understand. They may not understand why they're feeling this way. They may not realize that the medication is what's causing it. And if they don't have the follow-up visit with a prescribing physician, they can't tell that physician that, I'm really tired all the time, or I have pain.
In a family situation, I could look out for my mom to make sure it's okay, but in a foster care situation, that child may have no one looking out for their interests.
That's
frankly.
Right. That's right.
You also mentioned the cause of why these passports aren't really accurate, and one of them was staffing levels.
Right. Some of the explanations, I don't want to say excuses, because these public health nurses work very hard, and some of them said, I have to prioritize my time. If I have a child that has, needs a root canal, was an example in the audit report, I'm going to focus on that rather than the paperwork and making sure things get into the database. But what we said, as we talked earlier, is the federal government will pay a portion of these costs. Hire some administrative staff who will be responsible for inputting the data into the database, and that public health nurse can focus on that child specifically.
It sounds, though, that things are beginning to change. For example, the state's judicial council, the courts, had now adopted some new forms that have to be filled out before these psychotropic drugs are actually even prescribed. Is that going to solve the problem?
We think that will help significantly. That went into effect this year, in July of this year, and it was related to state law that was enacted. And I have to give credit. Judicial counsel really took this very seriously, modified the forms, and the forms are very clear now that a social worker needs to specifically identify what types of mental health services, behavioral services, is this child receiving in conjunction with the request for this child to be prescribed psychotropic medication.
So
we think it will help.
Starting to collect accurate information so these mistakes aren't made. Well, up next, we're going to talk about some other recommendations to ensure that foster kids aren't over-medicated in the foster care system. That's conversation up next. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. Children in foster homes are, by definition, wards of the state. And while some are troubled youth and need help with psychotropic drugs, the inappropriate use of those drugs can have short and long-term consequences. We're talking to the California State Auditor, Elaine Howell, about a recent report her office issued on the use of psychotropic medications in California's foster care system. So I'm wondering, this is not a problem that's unique to California. Lots of states are dealing, obviously, with foster kids. I'm wondering if other states maybe have found solutions. What are the best practices that are occurring maybe in other states?
Right. We talk in the report about a couple of states, the state of Texas and the state of Illinois. And in the state of Texas, they essentially, rather than having a fragmented system, it seems to be a very streamlined process where there's one agency that's responsible for all of these different activities as far as making sure the child has the appropriate prescriptions, if the child is prescribed psychotropic medications, what mental health services are being provided to that child, making sure that all of that is being managed centrally under one entity. In Illinois, it's a similar situation where they do manage the mental health services and they have psychiatrists, again, within a particular state agency. So it's not fragmented in those states. So there may be some best practices California can learn from those,
I assume
those two states.
If the passports were accurate, that could probably fill that need if we made sure those things were accurate. If they're not, of course, if the whole system falls apart. You've made also some specific recommendations for the legislative action, what you'd like to see the legislature do. What would you like to see them do to fix or address this problem?
Right. We have specifically made some recommendations to the legislature in really directing state agencies. We think the agency that should be essentially the lead agency when you have all this fragmentation, mm-hmm. you need to have one agency, and we think that should be the Department of Social Services, because that's the agency that has the database with most of the information about the children. What they're lacking is the information from healthcare services related to the medications. But there's an easy fix to that where that information can be input into the social services database, child welfare system. And then there can be coordination and collaboration between those agencies, but also we told the legislature to direct social services to work with local partners, the county welfare departments, the county probation departments, the caregivers, the social workers, et cetera, do a better job in collaborating and coordinating with them.
Yeah, it seems to me whenever you have a situation where no one really knows who the leader is, there is no leader, and then it just becomes, very disorganized very quickly.
Right.
You've also talked about the Medical Board of California and their role, the important role that they have here. What are you recommending the medical board do to help improve the situation?
Sure. We do have some very specific recommendations to the medical board that they need to be working with the Department of Social Services, certainly with healthcare services, in getting that medical information related to the children and try to identify perhaps some physicians out there who are prescribing multiple medications inappropriately, inappropriate dosages, have some kind of a trigger where they can investigate and determine whether or not they have problematic physicians. So we're telling the medical board, not just on the data that you currently have from DSS, but establish an ongoing process to do this kind of monitoring. There may be a reason why a child is prescribed a dosage that's higher than maximum, but it needs
it's
to be completely vetted.
It's not always wrong to do that.
Correct.
There may be a justification.
There may be a rational mm-hmm. explanation for that, but if you're seeing patterns of certain physicians over-prescribing or prescribing beyond the guidelines, that will trigger a question or an inquiry. And then you at least have assurance that, yeah, that's been well thought through, or we have a problem here and we need to address it.
You know, it's interesting. The San Jose Mercury News did an investigation. They found that in San Bernardino County, one psychiatrist prescribed antipsychotics to 328 foster children, 85% of his patients. Another situation in Riverside County where the person was a self-proclaimed spokesman for the pharmaceutical companies. And then another in San Diego where they once prescribed an antipsychotic to an out-of-control kindergartner. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the kind of examples of abuse of the system.
Right.
So what would you like to see state agencies like the Department of Social Services do that they aren't doing now to deal with troubled foster youth and over-medication? Is there...
Again, it ties back to a lot of what we've talked about today as far as making sure that, again, the Judicial Council has done a good job. It's making sure those forms that require court authorization are fully filled out and all of the information is in there. Making sure that when they go out and do some site visits at the counties, they check these health and education passports.
And those passports seem
very
important.
Compare it to the database that they have and make sure that that information is accurate and complete, because that really is the profile. That's the critical information for those children.
And what about counties then at the local level? Everything seems to happen at the local level.
Sure.
What would you like to see counties do?
Well, I think at the county level, again, the counties need to be more intimately involved as well as far as the social workers, the public health nurses. We think the counties should try to hire more people as far as from an administrative perspective so the public health nurses can continue to focus on caring for the children, but really paying attention to what's happening with all of these foster children.
One of those things is the follow-up, too, is really important. So the 30-day, well, 2 weeks ideally, but 30 days after receiving these medications, how are the kids doing?
Right. Making sure that all of that monitoring that should be taking place is happening at the local level.
And then finally, the last thing is sometimes you don't need medicines, right? Medications. Right. You can do other things maybe first before you try the medicines.
Right. And that's what the Academy for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry suggests. You usually try to start with a behavioral, providing mental health services, psychosocial services. And if that's not working, then you add in the medication. And it seems like it's happening the other way, where the medication happens first.
Hopefully this report will be a stimulus to get it going in the right direction. I want to thank our guest, California State Auditor Elaine Howell, for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Report on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, a local Valley program that leads the way. Discussion with Danny Morris, the Deputy Director of the Department of Social Services for the County of Madera, who leads Madera County's foster care program.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. Of all the county programs the state auditor reviewed, Madera County's was singled out, in a good way, because of the way it's handled the use of medications for foster care children. Our guest is the head of Madera County's foster care program, Danny Morris, the deputy director of the County of Madera's Department of Social Services. Welcome to the Madera Report Valley Views Edition, Danny.
Thank you.
So can we get a little background on Madera County's foster care program? How many children do you serve?
Currently in Madera County, we serve in and out of home care approximately 512 children throughout our entire county as of December of 2016. Of those children, approximately 346 are in out-of-home care, which means they're not with their biological parents.
Okay. So I understand that the way you foster care children come into the system, they're either going to come in via the welfare system or they're coming in versus the probation system. So how many approximately are coming in through the welfare system and how many are coming in through their probation system?
The numbers I mentioned there are our child welfare system. Probation has a separate system. Currently in probation,
Are they a bigger program than you or a smaller program?
Smaller.
Okay.
As of December of 2016, they had 7 children in out-of-home care.
Oh, quite a bit smaller.
Yeah.
Now you're carrying the lion's share. So do you see those trends increasing or decreasing or staying the same?
For Madera County, we've seen an increase. For example, in 2014, we had approximately 341 children in care and out-of-home care.
Now, I tell you, Danny, I really appreciate you coming here. You are totally loaded. Our listeners can't see this, but he is loaded with documentation, all the numbers you could possibly want about the foster care system in Madera. It's probably one of the reasons they're so well managed. You know the numbers, which is great. I appreciate that. Do you normally see, just out of curiosity, I would assume that when the economy gets worse, do you see more people entering the system?
Yes.
Generally, yes. I would think that'd probably be the case. So the state auditor, I was mentioning earlier, kind of singled you guys out as an example of kind of the best practices when it comes to medicating foster care children. As we talked in the earlier segment with the state auditor, you know, this happens because sometimes you have troubled youth, and one way to calm them down, frankly, is to give them medication. But what the state auditor found was in a lot of other counties, not Madera, but in a lot of other counties, they were over-prescribing medication because it's kind of a simple way to deal with the problem, just give them more meds. So Madera County is doing it right. So how do you handle reviewing prescriptions for psychotropic medications for foster children? Can you walk us through the process?
We have a very detailed process. Medication is not the answer for any child, for anyone at all. For any chronic condition, mental health considered chronic condition, diabetes, we don't say first medication. We say exercise, diet change, other options before you try medication. Same with mental health. We look at other options for our children prior to seeing medication. And so if a doctor or a clinician recommends medication, first thing we ask is what other alternatives have you tried?
So what kinds of alternatives would you try? Counseling?
Counseling, so talk therapy, behavior modification, working with the care provider on behavior modification, looking at sports. Are there any sports the child may like, or is it cheerleading, or is it dance, or art? Activities, other activities so that the youth can have the support and social emotional activities that can help support them versus a medication. And then once it's decided that medication is the best interest for the child, then we have a rigorous process that it goes
through. So can you walk us through that process? It's pretty rigorous from what I've been reading. So I know you have a public health nurse that gets involved and reviews things. So kind of walk us through the process.
When a prescriber first recommends medication, they submit what's called a JV-220 for the juvenile court. Our public health nurse receives that from our court clerk that receives it from the prescribing person. It's reviewed by
This is just not automatic when somebody says willy-nilly, hey, this kid needs medication. This is going to the court.
Yes.
And there's a very formal, rigorous process you guys use.
Correct.
Okay, so you get information from the court. This child may need medication. And then what happens?
Our public health nurse reviews it along with the social worker. There's discussions that take place. The public health nurse then reviews and says, okay, this medication may be appropriate based on this reason, then it's submitted to the court, and then there's a tracking system that's put in place at that time to review blood outcomes. So they're doing HP panels to review any outcomes that are being negatively affected by the child. The child's weight is being monitored, and also behavior modification that's being tried is also being monitored as well.
See if that might have some success. Yes. You know, I understand, though, that one of the things we talked about in the earlier segments with the state auditor was that, you know, some of the kids are being overprescribed. Mm-hmm. So you have a way to handle that. So if someone either is overprescribed in one class of medications or overprescribed based even on one medication but beyond the state averages, you also deal with those things too.
Correct.
When that happens, do you – What happens? You flag it, and then it goes to somebody for review, I assume.
It goes. It can go up to our director, who oversees our entire department, and to the public health director, and as well as the behavioral health director, to recommend if something should be changed. And so it also sends it to the court to advise that this is not in the child's best interest, and we recommend that medication not be prescribed. And then the court has the ultimate decision.
This is a regular Superior Court judge, or is there a judge specifically that deals with foster care children?
Superior Court judge that deals with foster care children. So
they have some knowledge and some experience about this. You know, it was interesting. We were talking in the earlier segments with the state auditor about the state judicial council, the courts, kind of saying, hey, listen, we need to have better forms. Mm-hmm. And so recently they came up with some forms that are going to get additional information. And it sounds like the information that they're, you know, requesting. You know, how much medication is the child receiving? Is it beyond state, you know, norms or goals or policies? Is very similar to what Madera County is already doing.
Yes.
Have you found any value added to what the courts are doing? Or do you see, hey, they're kind of doing what we're already doing?
It's always something. This addition is helpful. So we were already doing this process, and now we have the support of the courts that provides the oversight and support of getting input from the care provider, from the child, because those are the ones that are truly involved. And so there's now an official form that can be used statewide that has a voice for that child and the care provider.
It seems like that's going to really help things get a little more organized and more consistent, because it seems like things were being done very differently county to county.
Yes.
And again, Madera County was singled out as, hey, you guys are doing it right. It sounds like everybody's getting on board and following Madera County, which is good. You know, earlier in the program, the state auditor mentioned that it's not just the amounts and dosages of the drugs being prescribed, but also a general lack of follow-up visits, or psychosocial services for the medications that are being prescribed. How does Madera County ensure that the medications are only being used on foster children as necessary?
As I shared earlier, working with the care providers and working with the social workers and the clinicians and the public health nurses, we ensure we have a tracking system in place. And so we have systems in place to help track when medication should be reauthorized. We have the public health nurse reviewing labs to ensure that things are working appropriately for the child, their internal organs, their weight. There's no health issues arising, because with some of these medications, there can be side effects that impact their internal
organs. And one of the things they say is the short-term impact can be great. It calms down the child. Mm-hmm. But people don't really know the long-term implications of drugging, you know, children.
Exactly.
Okay? Particularly when you're younger, your body's more susceptible to the impact of drugs, and that can really be a problem. You know, it's interesting, as I'm listening to you talk, there seem to be a lot of caregivers surrounding that child, a lot of different people involved. How many people are kind of, you know, metaphorically touching that child in terms of helping them overcome, because a lot of these foster care children are coming from very difficult situations. How many people are involved in helping that foster child?
At a minimum, directly and indirectly, at least 10.
Wow.
Because you have the schools that are involved, you have the care providers, you have the social workers, you have analysts that are working behind the scenes for the county, you have clinicians, you have clerical staff that help support and track certain aspects. And so it could be several people involved.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like there's probably a lot of overlap between what you do in Madera and other counties, but you're doing some things that are kind of interesting and frankly better. One might even argue best practices. So if you're kind of sitting around a table with other foster care leaders in other either counties within the Valley or even around the state, what would you recommend that they do to ensure that their foster children aren't being over-medicated?
Recommend that the director be directly involved in ensuring not just the child welfare director, but the agency director be involved, both from child welfare, public health, behavioral health, so that the leadership in those organizations understand the impacts for children. And then you set policies in place and work with your partners to develop those policies, ensure those policies are followed, and look at what's best for children. Look at best practices, not just in California, but nationwide. And so what we did was look nationwide and look locally and as well as statewide, and found there are parameters, like LA County set up parameters on what medication should be used. And so we use that parameters locally to track. There's also a federal guide that helps educate youth on sexual medication, what the side effects are, and document those side effects. So we ensure that that's shared with our youth. But looking and constantly looking, not just saying, okay, we're doing good now. How can we continue to improve?
You know, that's really interesting you saying that. It's kind of that feedback. I think I noticed, I think you believe you have an MBA. I'm thinking
yes.
This is your business experience kind of coming to the fore, that you're not just settling for what you've done, but you're constantly reevaluating with that feedback loop and saying, okay, how can we improve the program? So you look around the country then for other
yes.
programs and what they do. Is there any state or locale that's particularly good in your mind? I've heard some good things about Texas, for example.
Yes. Texas had issues early on, and so they truly had to improve because there were things put in place. We learned through the National Center for Youth Law that truly impacted children, and so they had to go in and look at. And so we've looked at Texas. They've got some great parameters. But L.A., to be ironic, ironically, is one of the best, and we've looked at what they've done. They're so large. And they have things put in place, so we utilize, like, for example, their parameters, and now the state's taking on the parameters to look and track and how and look at the impacts of what can happen to children. And found it very beneficial, but looking, just having conversations with other locations.
You know, one of the things that I know we were talking about in an earlier segment about these health and education passports. Are you familiar with these?
Yes.
How do you make sure that those things are accurate? One of the things we talked about in the earlier segment with the state auditor was sometimes these things are not up to date and they're not really accurate. I mean, is there a process or procedure you have to make sure that those health and education passports are current and up to date and accurate?
Yes, we do. Once again, our public health nurses are critical in doing so. Social workers are not trained medical professionals. Public health nurses are, so they understand the medical component. And so we ensure that they input the information and utilizing the various doctors are looking at Valley Children's site, their medical records.
It sounds like that public health nurse is kind of like the leader of that group, of a group of people. It's kind of, you see sometimes, frankly, in cancer treatment, you have a bunch of doctors, but it's a coordinated strategy because they're all talking to each other. And similar, in mental health here with foster children, you're kind of doing the same thing.
Yes.
It sounds like. So that public health nurse is pretty important.
Yes.
We have to give her a thank you for all the work she or he is probably doing. So another thing that we're talking about in the earlier segment was better data collection. Do you see value in that, that other counties should be looking at making sure their data is up to date and accurate? Would that add a lot of value, or is it just paperwork?
It's value added because we try to monitor our numbers at all times and who's being prescribed and looking at the increase or decrease of children being prescribed medication. And so ensuring that you're collecting information, but also collecting the information related to the child's behaviors, looking at the child, how they're progressing academically, socially.
That's very labor-intensive. When you're spending that much time, with behavior modification and the rest of this, that's very labor-intensive work. I mean, you've really got to be paying attention. It's not just checking a box, it sounds like.
Correct.
Yeah. And so the last thing that they mentioned, that the state auditor was mentioning, was better rules and procedures. It sounds like Madera County, that's one of the reasons they were singled out as doing a very good job, is you have rules and procedures. And I think, as you already mentioned, you make sure those rules and procedures are being followed.
Correct.
Yeah, and so you'd probably say, yeah, that's something that other counties might want to emulate.
Yes.
Let me ask you one last question in this segment. We've got just a couple of minutes left. And that is, more generally, when you're talking about the foster care system in the state, what kinds of things would you like to see happen to improve the foster care system statewide? I'm guessing, more money is always probably the top of the list, but what would you like to see done?
I think more funding to help support foster care programs, more prevention dollars. Currently, dollars are used more for intervention. You've already involved, so now you're doing intervention than prevention.
Kind of prevention programs would you have for foster care? In other words, something to deal with maybe the family so it doesn't get to a crisis situation so the kid doesn't end up in foster care?
Correct. Because once a child leaves their home, they leave their environment, and we have teens coming in especially. You're trying to build social capital. You can't build social capital as a child, as a youth, to move yourself forward if you're moved out of your environment, move from your family, so you're moving from place to place. If you're not in a stable environment, you don't have the ability to build social capital. And social capital helps you build those friends, help build relationships, to build financial capital later on in life and build your future.
It's interesting. And on so many public policy issues, it's really a pay me now or pay me later. It's like if you don't invest in the front end, these kids have problems. And if you don't deal with a good foster care system, they may end up, having, criminal, crime issues or problems, end up in prison. And it gets more and more expensive. You put someone in prison, it costs you $50,000, $60,000 a year to incarcerate someone instead of spending $1,000 at the front end to mm-hmm. make sure they never go down, start on that path. So it exactly. just seems like it's a cost benefit thing. Do you see that? Do you see the real return on investment if you invest on the front end?
Yes. If you invest in the front end, you'll see a better return on human capital as well as financial capital on the back end, because you're investing in the family and helping support them moving forward than saying, okay, we're going to separate you. And now you cause more trauma, more issues for their family, and possibly, like you said, dependent upon other social service systems or the penal system.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like we all do. We all procrastinate, right? Oh, I really need a new roof. I really need a roof. I'm going to put it off. Instead of just patching it for a little bit of money, you end up replacing the entire roof because you didn't deal with it. So life is like that.
Yes.
Well, up next, what's the current state of foster care in the Valley? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
We're talking about some of the challenges Valley foster care programs are facing. And we're talking with the head of Madera County's foster care program, Danny Morris. He's the deputy director for the County of Madera's Department of Social Services. So up to this point, we've been talking about some really specific issues dealing with foster care programs, specifically how medication is sometimes used to deal with more troubled foster children. But many in the foster care system have very good experiences, actually. So what could you tell someone, you know, if they wanted to get involved and be a foster parent? What would you tell them? How does the process work?
The process has changed recently with resource family assessments, and so now there's the same thing. Currently, well, previously there were county foster homes, and then there were foster family agencies. Stays the same, but their assessment process to be approved were totally different. Now they're the same, and if you want to adopt a child, for example, or guardianship, once you're in the system, you had to go through another process. Now that process is done up front so that you can get through the process a lot sooner. So if you want to adopt a child, it goes a lot faster. And so
if someone wanted to adopt a foster child, bring them into their home, I assume your department goes out and checks out the home and then interviews the parent. Is that how it works?
Yes. There's a process. You go through an interview process. You assess the home. You also assess the care provider to assess to determine if they're appropriate to care for the child. And so there's a short process to go through. And once that's approved, placement can start taking place.
Do you find, you see a lot of baby boomers that are retiring and want to do kind of a second act in their life. Are you seeing a lot of baby boomers kind of saying, you know what, I might want to be a foster parent?
To be honest, and right now, no, we encourage them to do so because we're in
need. Maybe we give some people a thought about doing that.
Yes, because we're in need of foster parents because we want to keep kids in their community. A lot of our kids, for example, in Madera County, have to be placed in other counties because we don't have the homes in the community. And so,
what a great opportunity, though, for a child who's been through a difficult situation that then end up with a loving foster family who has good morals, good integrity, and can train, kind of help that child develop. I mean, it's also – I often argue, and I think most parents would agree with me, that the most important thing they ever do in their life is how they help their child develop. And so if you can help these foster kids, I think it'd be incredibly rewarding. And I have all this experience and knowledge, too, that you can give the kid – because you've been there, done that.
Yes.
I think that's pretty amazing. So that process, you encourage folks to do that?
Yes, we encourage people to apply. If you're in the Valley or anywhere in the state, contact your county and welfare agency to look at how you can become a foster parent, because there are a lot of kids that truly need caring and loving homes that they can remain in their community, remain in their county to help support them becoming.
And there's always a need, it sounds like.
Yes, there's always a need.
You don't have too many people applying for this thing.
Exactly.
You could use more. So when you have a foster care placement, do you generally find them to be short-term placements or long-term placements?
We're hoping for long-term, but sometimes they're short-term. Most kids have about 3 to 4 placements before they get to a stable home.
Okay, so when you say short-term, what are we talking? Are we talking months, weeks? As a general rule.
Months.
And then the longer-term placements, if they hit it off, if the parent, and is working well with the kid, the child is comfortable in the home, those things could go on for until they're 18, I assume.
21 now.
21?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So you're on the hook till 21. But I'm sure it's a great experience.
It's a great experience.
When those work out.
And then it's also support for that person that takes the child in, so there's financial support to help support.
What kind of financial support, now that you brought it up?
The county provides the rates vary, so it can range from $889. And by the end of 2017, it could go up to about $1,200 that a child can remain in the home and get that support based on the child's needs.
So what happens, you know, you have a child, let's say things work out, and so that's probably $1,200. I don't know. It would probably take care of the food and clothes and the basic necessities for the child. So the foster parent isn't costing them money.
Yeah.
But then when they're 18, they graduate from high school. If they want to go to community college or go to a university or to a trade school, who pays for that? At that point, is it on the child or the family, or does the state come in and help?
State still assists because there's still – there's called the Chaffee Grant that assists. There's also the Cal Grant that can assist, Pell Grants. And so they still qualify because they're a family of one because they're a foster child. So they receive those assistance. If they're adopted, things may change, but for the most part, stays the same. So looking – depending on their closure in the foster care system depends on how the assistance will play out for college.
Yeah, that could be very helpful, some of these – because that's another thing. Obviously – you know, the best poverty program is a job,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And so to the extent that they get good education, good training,
yes,
then they become a productive member of society. And you're taking a situation where the child is a troubled family situation that could very easily go down the wrong path and end up in prison, costing the state $50,000, $60,000, not to mention ruining their lives,
exactly,
versus this other alternative, a caring foster care home that could lead to a very productive member of society. So
exactly.
I hope our audience is listening and thinking about that, frankly. You probably evaluate the foster parents periodically.
Yes.
How often do you evaluate them, and what things are you looking for when you're evaluating a foster parent? Well, you know, once a child is already placed in a home.
We go in and have a monthly meeting with them, just discuss the child's progress, if there's any concerns, any other needs they may have, assess if there's – the placement is appropriate. The care provider says, yes, we appreciate it, we're loving the home, or we need more support. So we assess what's needed. Do you need mental health services? You know, are there extracurricular activities you want the child to be involved in?
Well, yeah, just curious, what percentage do you see of these children that are troubled youth that end up needing medications? Let's say they're put in a home. Is this like, you know, 50% of the children need medication? Is it 10% of the children?
Statewide average is about 6.4% currently,
okay,
that require medication, and that's been tapering down. And so –
I guess the point you're making is most of the children, foster children, when they come into a home, they don't need medication. They might need some help in behavioral help, maybe some guidance, some counseling, but this is not serious medication. That's a rare situation.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. I interrupted you about parents being evaluated. So they're evaluated periodically.
Yes.
Do you generally find they pass those evaluations?
They pass. Once a year, we do a true evaluation, but monthly contact is done to assess the child and assess and ensure that the placement is stable and the care provider has their needs being met. And so if there's things they need support.
Is that an in-home visit or they
yes.
call them up? Or
in-home visit.
Oh, so you're doing that once a month?
Yes.
So you're on top of it?
Yes.
Okay.
Statewide,
okay.
Yes.
So, we were talking about the kinds of services that might be provided to help foster children become self-sufficient when they leave foster care, because at some point, like any child, they're going to leave the home. We hope, right?
Yes.
So what services do you offer to help them live independently?
It varies from financial support. You get they can also – if they're on their own, they can also receive some public assistance. So they can receive Medi-Cal. They can receive SNAP, which is food stamps, financial support to help support them with their housing and stabilizing them when they move out. Or if they're with the care provider, they can still receive their financial assistance. After 18, they can still receive the same $800, for example, they received.
But does that $800 goes to the care provider, not the child?
Go to the care provider, yes.
Right.
It also helps support the child, so giving funds to them by the
– By the way, this is interesting. It just makes me think of this. That, when you give them the $800, it goes up to $1,200 to the foster care parent. Do you ask for an accounting of that money? Or do you make the assumption that, they're going to feed them appropriately and clothe them appropriately?
No accounting from us. We assume they're going to do those things for the child.
And you're checking on a monthly basis to make sure that that's happening.
Yes.
And there's an ongoing, I assume, ongoing communication and relationship with the child. So if they at any point have any problems, they can contact, your department and say, hey, there's some issues here. So that you're constantly monitoring the situation.
Yes.
Okay.
And so Trustful has private conversations with the child, conversations with the care provider, and they also talk to the schools and others that are involved with the child, just ensuring that there's collaboration as a team. And then every 3 months, there's what's called a child and family team where the child, the care provider, and the treatment team come together to discuss.
Wow, that's a lot of people involved.
Yes.
The social worker, when a social worker is dealing with a foster child, how many children are they kind of responsible? How many are they monitoring on an average basis?
On an average, it varies county to county, but on average, maybe about 30 children, 35 children.
Yeah. It sounds not unlike a teacher, right? A teacher classroom is about 30 kids that they're monitoring, but it sounds like this is pretty intense. They're doing regular reports and they're coordinating the services, et cetera.
Yes.
I want to get back to the – before we end up here, we've only got about a minute or so left. So these services that help them transition to become – live independently, does that include training and life skills assessments and those kinds of things?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So what kinds of things would you be talking to a kid about to make sure that they're able to transition and live on their own?
Financial management.
That's important.
Yes. Looking at, you know, how to take care of themselves, and so clothing, you know, how to not to get the credit reports. So we pull their credit report and monitor their credit as well while they're in care and when they exit care to ensure that their credit isn't impacted, someone has not used their Social Security number.
So, you know, we've got about 20 seconds left. I just want to ask you about any success stories that come to mind when you think, you know, a child that went through the system and now they're doing really impressive things.
I recall a young man that I worked with several years ago. He's now living in Los Angeles, living prosperously and working for security guard. Early on, you would have thought he would have been a true failure. But with the collaboration, his CASA worker, social worker, and the clinician really helped see the young man moving
forward. And a productive member of society.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Danny. I really appreciate that. We were talking with Danny Morris, the deputy director for the County of Madera's Department of Social Services. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed in the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed in the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.